Okay, so I just want to spend 5 minutes or as little as possible beyond that, finishing off from this morning, and then Alessandro will go on to talk about n equals 1 and other issues, I'm not quite sure. So let me just summarize kind of where we got to, which is pretty close to the end, actually. Let me leave that up. So the example we were looking at was n equals 2 super young Mills in two dimensions, Euclidean. And we got ourselves down to a lattice action, which took the following form. It was essentially the same as the, not make that an integral, make a sum, I guess, on the lattice. It had the same form basically as the continuum with one or two subtleties. So we had eta of x, phi bar plus chi dagger 1 2 f 1 2 chi dagger 1 2 b 1 2 plus sine mu dagger d mu plus phi bar plus actually some Hermitian conjugates. I'm not going to talk much about that. Okay, so if I take the Q variation, where this is the Q transformation on the lattice, it's almost the same as in the continuum. This gives me this twisted form of the super young Mills action we talked about before. All right, so I'm not going to say much more. Okay, this is clearly gauge invariant because I'm going to choose the gauge transformation properties of chi 1 2, this guy, and f 1 2 to be conjugate to each other. So it's f 1 2, I have no choice in this f 1 2. F 1 2 in this theory has to be equal to d 1 plus U2, okay, because I'm trying to stick close to the continuum, and these are my covariant difference operators on the lattice, which play the role of exterior derivative. In the continuum would be exterior derivative. So I have to be a derivative on whatever this field is here, which is this guy. Interesting enough, if I write this out, you get, using the rules for differentiation we went through before, this is actually u1 of x, u2. Let me just stick to my notation here so I don't screw up. U mu x plus mu minus u nu x, u mu x plus nu. So this thing has various nice properties. If I take this and do a weak field expansion, this is nothing more than the continuum Young-Mills strength to leading order in the lattice spacing. When you come to do the variation in Q here, you'll produce a BF and a B squared term. When you integrate the B out, you'll get an FF dagger term. So your final action will involve FF dagger. Okay, F12 times its adjoint. Again, that's just dictated by the structure. But if you come to, so the actual final action will involve F12 dagger. I want to integrate out the B and the B dagger. Just like that was true in the continuum, basically, as well. Plus.
Simon, yeah? Can I just ask, B field, does that have values in the gauge proof? Or
Algebra. Also on the lattice. Everything does except the U field, which is the exponential of something in the algebra.
That's the rule of pleasant.
Yeah. You have to keep the U field compact because you don't know how to write down a gauge invariant theory otherwise. But actually, all the other fields.
If you do gauge transformation property, B field is a target field.
Well, this, remember, contains these indices, so it has this rather peculiar gauge transformation property that I went through last time.
It takes the value of the algebra.
Right.
So gauge transformation property should have a joint type.
Yeah, but it transforms just like the F12.
Right. It transforms like my chi 1 2 or like my d 1 psi 2. Uh-huh. So it transforms. So just like we said last time, b 1 2 of x goes to g of x, b 1 2 of x g of x plus 1 plus 2 to minus 1. Okay. It's a Plaquette field, right? So I just wanted to point out here that if you actually write out this guy and multiply by its dagger, what do you get? Well, rather than doing it all here, I'll tell you what you get. The leading term in this is minus u mu of x, u nu x plus mu, u dagger mu x plus nu, u dagger nu of x. In other words, it's the Wilson-Plaquette term. And then you get another piece, which is something like u mu dagger u mu of x, right, u nu x plus nu, u nu dagger x plus nu. So along this contour, u dagger u equals I, this is a constant, and this collapses to the usual Young-Wilson action. Okay, that didn't have to happen, right? Neither is it totally obvious that when I take the q variation as ff, I get nothing more than, so q on f, I get exactly d1 plus psi 2 minus d2 plus psi 1, which is exactly the same structure as the continuum. So again, as far as I can see, that didn't have to happen.
That's a really naive question. If I, if B is transforming like that, does it stay in the algebra? Is that...
Well, I guess usually you're only interested in the infinitesimal form of that, actually. But I think so. Yeah.
I'm used to lattice letting me do arbitrary U transformation.
Right, right.
Is the trace of that obviously 0? It's y.
No, no, not. Well, the trace, remember, I'm thinking of un anyway, so it's not traceless.
Yeah. Oh,
so maybe that's.
But I'm afraid that you can't really restrict it completely to the algebra because F12 itself doesn't lie in the algebra either. It has
no.
Terms.
That's true.
The envelope of the algebra.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't thought about it. There's no problem with the trace, but.
I guess if, yeah, okay, if you're going down to U1, then the T's are essentially.
I think it's okay, but. Yeah, I think it's okay. But I hadn't really thought about it, actually. Yeah. Okay, so that's just.
The higher power, the U is not happening, the F is not emission.
So, anyway, as long as you restrict to this contour, you see the action reproduces the ordinary Young-Mills action, in fact. Which was at first sight a bit surprising, but turns out to be true. And so in principle, there's nothing to stop you simulating this model. And that's what we're doing right now. So we haven't got any code except in the quench theory right now, but we're working on the dynamical code, and that's not, it's tricky, but it's not, it's all very concrete. You have to, and we can test some of these ideas about the restoration of the ordered entities. In other words, is Q on some gauge invariant operator equal to zero in this theory restricted to the along this contour, and we can check that numerically and see whether that conjecture is right. As I say in the continuum, people assume this is true, that you can essentially complexify the theory in the way I described, but on the lattice you really have to face that issue and be honest about it. And so the easy thing to do is to, you can do some perturbative checks, but it will be nice to just check it, you know, in the context of that simulation. So if I may borrow two more minutes, let me say something about n equals 4. So,
because you started with n is 2 in the continuum.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have more or less a direct lattice implementation because of the Keller-Dirac fermions.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to
right.
Complexify.
So, right. So the action involves this, you know, omega dagger d minus d dagger omega in the action. So you'd get the determinant when you did a naive integration of d minus d dagger. Mm-hmm. All right. And that's not actually what you want. You want something which is closer to the Pfaffian of this.
Because in the continuum you have.
Right. So when you come to doing a simulation by fiat, you stick in a half and hope for the best.
So it's at the level of the simulation.
Yeah, you have to integrate the fermions out to keep it gauge invariant before you restrict to the real line. Otherwise, that's what we were
saying, that the NS2 symmetry is still there in the naive sense.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. But you have to do things like this.
Yeah, because that's a little bit different than from Kawamoto, says that he really loses some of it explicitly in the lattice.
Right. Well.
Transcription of the keyword.
Yeah, it's just DA, of course. Okay. Anyway, we should discuss that later. I agree there are several things that are not manifestly clear to me, but. Okay, so you can try to play this game with n equals 4 super young mills. Now in 4 dimensions, that's a natural place to be. And of course, that's of great interest to people. The twisting goes through pretty much the same. This thing has an R symmetry, which is SU4, which certainly contains SU2 cross SU2. And so what you can do is decompose the spinners of the theory now on this SU2 cross SU2, which means that I can take an SU2 index from here and associate it with the I here. So I can think of psi as a matrix, just like in 2 dimensions. Okay, and I can imagine expanding that matrix on a basis of products of gamma matrices. Just the natural thing as in 2 dimensions. Only now, of course, there are more of these guys. In fact, there are a total of 16 of these p-form fields, which of course is exactly what you need to parameterize the real 16 real supercharges of n equals 4. So the thing that's analogous to the 2-dimensional calculation is indeed n equals 4 in 4 dimensions. It has the right fermion content to fix.
I thought Witten's theory was twisted n equal to 2.
Yes, this is not Witten's theory. This is.
So right,
Witten's theory is n equals 2.
You can still write it as a topological V theory.
You can, but it's tricky to latticize it for reasons I can tell you. I don't know how to do that one. I don't know how to do this one, but I'm closer to doing this one than the n equals 2 one. So what you expect then, looking at this, is a Dirac Kähler field in 4 dimensions will have a scalar component, a link component, Bouquet-like component, and then in principle something with 3 indices and no indices again, or 3 indices and 4 indices rather, but of course those are equivalent to a vector and another scalar, okay, because you can just multiply by the epsilon tensor. So that's the natural field content, and of course associated with that you might expect there'd be some sort of commuting Kähler-Dirac field, which again I can write in terms of a scalar, the gauge degree of freedom, the vector potential A mu, a multiplier field B mu nu, a vector V mu, and another pseudo-scalar C. And indeed, if you go look up your papers in topological field theory, you'll find there's a twist of n equals 4 super young mills with precisely this field content. Okay. In fact, and the Q transformations are just in the continuum, are just the obvious guess you would make. From the V equals the D equals 2 guys. So there's an A mu goes into psi, V mu goes into lambda, this field here. So in other words, the transformations work vertically just like they did before. Q on eta equals phi bar. Q on the chi mu nu equals B mu nu. And Q on rho equals C. Q on psi mu equals a D mu phi. This is all in the continuum, but now you have this technology, you can import it to the lattice in principle. Of course, phi V mu, it has to be a gauge transformation parameter on V because lambda is conjugate to V. So when I do Q squared on V, I'll get a gauge transformation with parameter phi on V, just like in 2 dimensions. Q on phi bar is Q on eta. Q on eta equals, this is wrong, sorry, this should have, yeah. No, it was right. Oh, okay, that's right. Q on D equals phi chi. Just like, so it's what you would have guessed from the 2-dimensional situation. It's very, very simple. Again, you can attempt to latticize it just like we did in 2 dimensions. B ultimately will be a multiplier field and get integrated out, as will C actually, leaving you with these two scalars, phi bar, A mu, and V mu. And indeed, you can go look up a twisted form of n equals 4, which is precisely written in the scale in terms of those degrees of freedom.
Can you twist the energy momentum tensor the way you did for n equals 2?
Yep, I don't have time to do it. We can talk about it afterwards because I want to let Alessandro. But yes, there's the way you can twist it to the level of the supersymmetric algebra. Just it's similar. So you can produce a twisted algebra, in fact, and show that energy momentum tensor is Q exact, just the same way. Okay, so I'll just leave it that this is not completed yet because of various problems in formulating the gauge fermion in four dimensions, which I'd be happy if someone could tell me how to do it, in fact. Yeah. So just briefly to say in conclusion, since I've taken well longer than I said, theories with extended supersymmetry in Euclidean space can often be discretized while preserving both gauge invariance and at one of these twisted supersymmetries. The lattice theories are local and free of doublers because you're using Kähler Dirac fermions. At the end of the day, it's well known you can latticize those theories without inducing extra zeros in the Brillouin zone corners or whatever. In fact, the discretization comes from this geometrical formulation. And in principle, you could try to study these things non-perturbatively. And so we're doing that in two dimensions. And if that were successful at some point, one might feel enthusiastic enough to look at the four-dimensional case, providing one can work it out. But at the end of the day, the theories in the lattice theories look very, the idea is to make them look very similar to the continuum, so the process can be made very systematic and straightforward. Okay, thanks.
So, when you introduce these funny extra fields, these, as you said, like the Plaquette ones in the two dimensions, or like the row and the other things, are transforming like
absolutely
in funny ways, which is very reminiscent of what Kaplan's getting from a completely different point of view.
Yeah.
Because he gets gauge fields on diagonals and stuff also.
Yeah.
And is there any connection?
I don't know. Joel Geet, who's in Toronto, told me that he could almost get Kaplan's to work this way with a very, in terms of a very funny gauge-fixing fermion. So maybe, but he ran into the problems of complexification and kind of stopped. So he said it almost looked like it was a perverse choice of the starting action, but basically was similar. Obviously, in the continuum, it had to agree. But I don't really know of any other connection. They seem to be able to, you can treat similar models, basically. I hope this one doesn't have the same problems that his does in terms of the fermion determinant. He has a lot, basically that's complex in his case. That's sort of proven now. So it makes it tricky. And I hope that's not true here. It's certainly not true in the naive continuum limit, where I can prove at least the two-dimensional theory, the determinant is positive and real. That's I can't prove it at finite lattice spacing. So one hopes at least the sign problem is reduced as you go to a continuum limit, if there is one at all. But the proof fails in a finite lattice spacing that we'd use to prove it at zero lattice spacing. So I don't really know. We'll find out soon enough, actually.
Well, his formulation does not really allow the full lattice aggregation of four regions. Just
right. But Sugino tomorrow is talking about the same constructions, not perhaps in this geometrical language, but the idea of using a twisted starting point for your lattice action. If you don't use this formulation in terms of Kähler Dirac fields, you can actually force everything to live at a point, which eliminates a lot of the problems in, and you, so you can look at n equals two theories in four dimensions that way as well as n equals four. So the idea of twisting is broader than that I just sketched here. This is really twisting plus a sort of geometrical, forcing the theory to be very geometrical. And you don't have to be so geometrical. You can still use the idea of preserving Q squared equals zero as your supercharge and not necessarily go all the way to having these funny gauge transformation properties of the field. So you don't have to do that. I guess you're going to talk tomorrow about it.
Coming back to the D equals 2 case,
mm-hmm.
you somehow complexified the field
yeah.
and the later constraint.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. If everything works that way again, why don't you work with consistently only with a constraint variable? Why do you have to complexify?
Well, you might be able to do something like that, but if you take the analog of these transformations and when you replace A by U, as we did in two dimensions, then if U dagger U is always one, you have the Q on U dagger is related to Q on U through some nonlinear function of the U's. So it makes it harder to split the theory into two copies.
That suggests that you cannot work consistently on the real values. Then if you later constrain mm-hmm. the real values, it might spoil some of the nice properties of
absolutely.
The
Absolutely. Yeah. Spoil it. It could do. I agree. That's why I want to look at it numerically, because I don't really know how to proceed.
Well, but before looking at the numerical, I said, analytically, can you see any problem or not?
No, but I haven't done any serious calculation that would reveal a problem either, so to be fair. Right. And there's something that helps you, which is that these actions are Q-exact. So you can take beta to infinity to do your calculations, which means you're then infinitesimally close to the continuum. And so, I mean, I tried to construct an argument rigorously along those lines and failed, but these are kind of special. Look, the structure in these theories is kind of special. Yeah. The hope is that the watered entities will, the fact you're on the real line when you measure a watered entity will not, or do your path integral, the theory should know something about the fact it's embedded in this theory with a larger symmetry.
Yeah.
So that's the hope.
From the path integral viewpoint, for example,
right.
Complex variable and real variable, say, path integral measures are quite different.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of complex, you have to take d phi and d phi dagger
mm-hmm.
in that combination. And in that combination, maybe everything will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Then later you insert some delta function, say phi
yeah.
minus phi dagger.
Right.
And by that procedure, I was wondering if some of the symmetry properties are spoiled or not.
Well, the Q symmetry is spoiled for
gauge
certain.
Invariance
gauge invariance is spoiled.
The symmetry is spoiled, right? The measure is no longer supersymmetry.
Yeah.
No, not the Q symmetry.
No, because you have to be a little bit careful because his simulations will be where he takes the square root of this determinant.
Yeah.
And that, so the naive interpretation of complexified fields in the path integral, mm-hmm. I don't think applies in this case because you take the square root of this.
Right. Thing. But by the way, you could, of course, simulate the fully complex theory. The action is perfectly real and bounded from below. It's not a problem with doing that. It's just you think that's the wrong theory.
No, but your hope is that by taking the square root, you're
right.
basically.
Right.
Doubling off the degrees of
right, right. It's a different kind of doubling than the usual doubling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, right. I mean,
I
as we said before.
If you have a delta function as was proposed, okay, then it would exactly cancel, I mean the determinant to the power of 1/2, right?
Yeah.
It's but if you take the naive determinant, then you may have to worry about the locality again, no?
I don't think so, because it's a different, you're not square rooting it for the same reason. Right, I mean, it's really a question of whether you're imposing a reality condition on your fermions or not. So it's different from the usual square root. Right? These theories automatically have two fermions in them, in two dimensions, so they automatically soak up the number of flavors you'd have kicking around from, if you want, in the staggered language. So there's no need to square root for that reason. The square root comes in because of this complexification. That's really a reality conditional that you were trying to impose on the Kähler-Dirac field, which is a sort of has a different flavor, to so to speak, than the usual problem. but I don't know whether it's. I honestly don't know whether it's legitimate. I'd like to know more.
But say if you claim that you are still really local, you have to prove that you are passing there some sort of split in the product or something, right?
Yep.
But you have not proved it.
No, I haven't proved it. No. I'm going to rely on the computer to prove it.
Is there any Hamiltonian version of this?
No, I don't think so. I think you can construct one. So why not? That seems like you're relaxing it, I think. So if you let time be continuous.
But is there again similar
actually, I'm not sure. The Dirac Kähler is a bit funny in all dimensions. I mean, I think there's a doubling that comes in there, isn't there? The right hand is most natural in even number of dimensions, I believe.
Ah, oh.
I'm not sure. I can't remember what happens in all dimensions.
There's an even dimension, but it's only.
Well, probably you can do it on continuum. There's no problem at all.
Yeah.
So just let this
I would imagine you could do it.
You mean d minus d dagger has a problem in three dimensions, is what you're saying, on the lattice.
Right. Yeah, but if you want more details, we can discuss it offline. By the way, it's written up in a paper, but I don't think I have it here. You just go search my name and find out.
Okay, very good.
I'll sign it monthly, November. Probably want to plug that in. Come and do it for you.
The microphone, you
Thank you.
Yeah, you can probably get a website to you.
Okay, so there are two ways to realize supersymmetry or to study lattice supersymmetry. The first one is to abandon the idea of a lattice supersymmetric theory and then recover it in the continuum limit. I mean, construct a non-supersymmetric theory which has a supersymmetric continuum limit. And so this is, approximate, let us say. And this idea is very nice and has been used for several people. And for example, has been applied to n equal 1 super Jan Mills using the Kurchin-Veneziano formulation that uses Wilson fermions. And this has been put on the lattice by Montvailles. He's the father of all this machinery. And I would like to review some of these results today in the first part of this informal discussion. Then another way to realize or to study a supersymmetry on the lattice is to keep an exact supersymmetry algebra on the lattice and hope that this is strong enough to recover all the supersymmetric theory in the continuum limit. And without doing fine-tuning . So this idea has been used for Supriya Mills theories by several people here, Kaplan, Sugino, Katiral, etc. And I would like in the second part of my talk explain what Marisa Bonini and I did for the four-dimensional Vesuvian model that uses Ginsberg-Wilson fermion. And I will show you why we say that we recover the continuum limit without fine-tuning. So why it is important to study lattice supersymmetry? Well, it's important because there are non-perturbative effects, for example, in super Jan Mills n equal 1, which are similar to QCD, and so one can learn something of super Jan Mills numerically too. So n equal 1 super Jan Mills is analogous to QCD because, for example, there is a spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking. Which is interesting in this model is the U1 symmetry is broken to the zeta 2 NC, where NC is the number of colors, by the anomaly. And then it's spontaneously broken to zeta t by a value different of 0 of the Guino condensate. So this mechanism here, this one, can be studied on the lattice, I mean, by numerical simulation. I will show you what has been done in this. So then there is a mass spectrum. Which is also a non-perturbative aspect. And then the word identities. One can study word identities on the lattice and see what they can tell us, about the theory, if they hold or not. And also one can study the renormalization constant of the supercurrent entering in that theory. So So the YAM means N equal 1, the action is similar to QCD. Let me briefly. This is the covariant derivative. So where, I mean, the only difference is that the fermion is a Majorana fermion in the adjoint representation of the gauge group. And this is the Gluino mass. So for n equals 0, for mass of the Gluino equal to 0, this action, I mean, the interval is invariant under the following supersymmetry transformations. I am in the continuum now. And then the bar. Where sigma is, okay. So this action here for m equals 0 is invariant under this supersymmetry transformation. And then also from here, one can calculate the supercurrent, I mean the neutral current, which is so this current here is the divergence of this current is zero. I mean, it's a conserved current, and also hold this relation. Now, one also expect that there must be some Ward identities that hold, which are this one here, where this is the renormalized mass and chi r is this combination here. So SUSY happened when the mass of the renormalized mass of the Gluino is equal to zero, while an inclusion of the mass softly broken supersymmetry. So let me now talk about the spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking. So if I introduce this piece on the Lagrangian, the action is not anymore supersymmetric, but for m0 equal to 0, we have that the action has a global chiral symmetry, which is u1 lambda. This lambda goes to this is anomalous because the divergence of the current is different from zero. I mean, it's proportional to a constant, well, a constant times f. So a group is expected to be broken to the zeta 2 nc by the anomaly, and then this is spontaneously broken to zeta 2 by Witten, by a value of the Gluino condensate different from zero. And the consequence of this spontaneously chiral broken is a first order phase transition at the mass of the Gluino equal to zero. And
So it doesn't happen unless you actually, okay, yeah. So you need supersymmetry for it to happen.
Sorry?
You need supersymmetry for the spontaneous breaking to occur. That's why the first order.
Yes. Yeah. So the first order phase transition implied the existence of NC degenerate vacua. So let me explain this better. So existence of degenerate ground states with different orientation of the Gluino condensate. So let me write down the Gluino like this. Where k is equal to 0, 1. Okay, this is the expectation. So in the S.
Actually, I thought it was an exact calculation of the condensate. I thought it was one of those divine things you could compute exactly to a Hawking driver.
Which one? Which paper?
Well, a Shipman and people like that. I thought there are arguments that it.
Well, there are.
Quantum corrections beyond one loop or something, right? Some special.
Well, I think so. Yeah, the value of the Gluino condensate has been calculated in the past by several people. I mean, using Strawn instanton. Yeah.
Right. It's an instanton.
And the wake capping, and there was also a.
Exactly.
I mean, there were not agree between then and then the end.
Right.
Yeah. So, for SU2, you expect to degenerate ground state. With opposite value of the Gluino condensate. While for SU3, you expect three degenerate ground states. So this thing can be checked on the lattice, and this has been done. I will show you now what's happened. So
I don't quite remember how it works, but I think it's because you only get one loop contribution. You can argue that there's no infrared problem with the instantons. I don't remember the details, so anyone else might
remember. It's the zero
in the background. The zero is saturated by the charge volume instantons. But there is a bit of a problem that the instanton calculation itself, of course, would have more zero modes than the two that will give this condensate. So you need to do more.
But look at the four-point function you can use.
Yeah, yeah. And then you use the
factor section dependence.
And you use clustering to assume.
Right.
And at finer temperature, people have been able to use these monopoles calculated. But then the assumption is you have to go down to low temperature. You might still need a phase transition.
So, near the supersymmetric point, which corresponds to mass of the Gluino equal to zero, for SU2, it is expected a first-order phase transition in an order parameter. So let us take this as an order parameter. So a first-order phase transition can be seen in a numerical simulation as a two-double structure of this order parameter. And that's happened because the system in that point is metastable, so there is a flip-flop between the, I mean, in this case, the two degenerate vacua, in other cases, et cetera, et cetera. So, let me write down this. So this is the hopping parameter. The hopping parameter, which is something like 8 plus 2 and 0. And the expectation for SU2 is that you have, okay, here there is a 1 over 8, and then it start to be something like that. So this is the line corresponding to the critical hopping parameter where the supersymmetry is, and this depends on beta, of course. And so this is a first order phase transition or a crossover. I mean, that we don't know yet. I mean, one should make simulation in bigger lattices in order to see what's the end here.
This picture implies that you've got on the lattice, so you put a Wilson term in. And so the Wilson term, well, the fundamental term is it breaks the chiral symmetry. But I guess the point is the Wilson term here keeps this Z2 and Z or something symmetry. So that's the point.
Sorry, can you? I mean, in the Kurchin-Veneziano formulation, supersymmetry is breaking by the lattice. Then it's breaking by the Wilson term in the soft
Wilson term is still so preserving. It's, I guess it's preserving the chiral, the discrete chiral symmetry or not?
No, if you introduce it, no, you don't have it.
Oh, you must, because it's in the adjoint representation. So therefore, the adjoint all the Zn's. What happened to one? So this is different than n equals one QCD in that sense, that there still remains the Zn. So you can still have this first order. Okay.
So also in the Kurchin-Veneziano formulation, you recover supersymmetry for mass of the gluino, for vanishing mass of the gluino, and the supersymmetric limit is recovered in the continuum limit at the same point as the chiral limit. So that's why we can study this pattern of supersymmetry break. So I don't know. I would like to show you the pictures that I will sketch here first and then. So, in the supersymmetric limit, so what you do in a numerical simulation is that you fix beta to some value, which means that you are fixed G, and then you study the value of the distribution of the gluino condensate for different values of your hopping parameter. So when you see that there is a two double structure in your distribution of the gluino condensate, you know that roughly in this region you get the critical hopping parameter. I mean the value in which the supersymmetry is recovered. So what you see is that if your k is far away from your critical hopping parameter, so you see that your gluino condensate, I mean, you will see one Gaussian structure in your order parameter. While if you are approaching where K is approaching KC, so you will see a two double structure of your gluino condensate. And then again, when I am again far away from the critical. Sorry? Sorry?
What is the horizontal direction?
That's a comment.
The vertical direction is lambda bar. What's the horizontal?
So this is the distribution probability. Yeah, okay. So I will show you if I can. Sorry. I mean, here there is this distribution of the gluino, the probability distribution of the gluino condensate for the lattice size 6 to the cube times 12 for different values of the hopping parameter. And you see that where here, in this figure, the K critical is 0.5. So you see that if you are simulating, for example, to k equal to 0.19, you have a Gaussian distribution. If you are near this region here, you start to see two Gaussian distribution, I mean two peaks. And then again, far away, you have one Gaussian distribution. Here you can see that the two double structure is not very, I mean, you cannot see very well, but this was because the simulation were done in a rather small lattice. If you would be able to do this in bigger lattices, you would observe that your system, I mean, that this structure, in any case, you are able to fit this figure here with two double Gaussian curves, and this means to you that this is, it is a two-double structure figure. This is for SU2 theory, and also has been done it for SU3. I think so. I have the picture here.
The idea that it's located at infinity, the first one weakens and becomes continuous, and then how do you take the continuum limit by? It's first order, that looks.
I think that's right. I
so
think that's
you have to go to Beta equals infinity to find a subcritical endpoint. Is that the idea?
No, just in the opposite. It should be, in any case, the first order phase transition in the quantum limit. Even if it is a crossover only at final beta, which cannot be seen from this data. But so that's, I think, is an interesting question in general, how you do the quantum limit for.
Right, it's a correlation.
I would say. I would say one should add a little bit of mass, some positive mass, and during the process of going to the quantum limit, also this mass should go to zero. So I mean, this is a question of how you define, yes?
Right.
Because you cannot define a quantum field theory sitting on a first order phase transition, because then you have, you know, bubbles and everything which is not a quantum field theory. So, therefore, you have to go away from the first order phase transition in order, and only in the quantum limit you have to go there when you can. I mean, this is my understanding. I don't know whether there anybody else knows it better, but this is my understanding.
Now, is this one of these field theories where the beta function vanishes? Or
No.
This is still abstract.
Okay, it is a zero beta function.
Not one of those weird things we heard about last week.
So yeah, what you do here is that you fix your beta. And then you go through, you would have done the
other. Right, this is how you take the continuum limit if you're sitting on the first.
But you have to fix a beta which is in that asymptotic scaling.
Is the first one phase transition
in continuum
is expectation?
In the continuum is the expectation that it is a first order phase transition. Whether it is really a first order phase transition at final beta is not clear. It could just be a crossover which tends to a first order phase transition if you go to the continuum limit.
And you were saying that you wanted to avoid difficulties in being in different phases, but in the continuum, of course, when you have this condensate, you have different regions, and you have the domain walls in between.
Then the spectrum is completely different. I mean, of course, if you study a system with a first order phase transition, just sitting on the first order phase transition, then you have first order tunnel.
Yeah, you have to be careful how you approach it, but the thing
is. You just have a different spectrum. If you have one vacuum, you have one spectrum, which is what is, for instance, described by the Venezia-Yankelevich formula. If you have two vacuum, then you have additional, you have just double this, because, you know, you can have one vacuum in the other vacuum, or if MC vacuum, so you have MC times as many states as described by the Venezia-Yankelevich formula, then, of course, you have the tunneling between the vacuum, which has, exactly sitting on the on the phase transition as very small energy. So it's, I think the quantum field theory is assuming that we are in a unit vacuum and not in not sitting on a first order phase transition.
So you would keep slightly off the line and take beta to infinity to take the continuum limit. Then you would imagine in that theory taking m that moving towards the line.
Yes, and by
the
order, if you the tunneling is of course is getting suppressed.
Right.
Because you have to go to a large zone at the same time, and therefore you are safely staying in a one vacuum.
So you drive beta to infinity, v to infinity, and then you approach the line afterwards.
Okay, the parameters are only the Guino mass, right?
The Guino mass.
Yes.
Of course, if you would have n equal 2 or n equal 4, the problem would be more interesting, but
In this case, of course, this is a very simple theory.
So there are also other attempts for SU3, which I show you here. And I mean, so here it was fixed at beta of 5.6, I mean. And then we start the simulation at kappa equals 0.195. And you can see here a sort of, I mean, it seems to be that it is approaching some two double structure. I mean, it cannot be seen very well, but I mean, this curve here is there are two Gaussian distribution here. So, and so it would be interesting to study SU3 because I mean, in SU3 there are things that are very much interesting. For example, CP violation and. It may be that this thing here is also different from zero, and one could. Half an hour.
I think for some reason we can't go for another half hour. So.
Sorry?
The question is on time. I mean, I think we could certainly go for another half hour, as far as everybody's concerned, right? So that's
okay. I would be very happy. I don't know.
I don't think we're under
any pressure to get out of here.
So let's relax a lot of
time.
Yeah, because I asked him to tell me.
So he asked me to show like half an hour.
Okay, so I would like also to mention briefly what it was done for the war identities, and I mean in super young miss, and then I will. I think so. I don't have time to talk about the spectrum, but okay.
Just totally back. The spectrum presumably is some of the luminone and some of the blue balls, right? Which are degenerate distances.
Yes.
Basically, it's a massive theory.
The problem with your present calculation is that the volume is so we cannot.
I'm expecting,
of course, bound states of Vs and Luinos, and of course they are in objects, so you can make any number of gluons and any number of Luinos can form a state.
Right. Okay, sorry.
It's still in the finite volume, of course, you can take the continuum limit,
yes.
And although you might not be in the phase where this spontaneous energy breaking is occurring, so simply make some predictions about the spectrum, so it's nevertheless still interesting to see the continuum.
Does he or does she or does it?
in a very small volume, that should be no breaking because the instantons should be sort of.
Are these predictions known?
I don't know if anybody worked it out, but if the supersymmetry is maintained, then you should be able to check, see this in the spectrum. It would be interesting still in a finite volume to look at the continuum limit. But you will not see the prediction based on the infinite volume continuum limit. That will be different.
Well, I think with the present computers, you know, mm-hmm. would be absolutely no problem to do a large volume calculation at this value. But I mean, somebody should do it. Mm-hmm. And presumably, we're not the first priority.
Mm-hmm.
See, there are also some attempts in the literature to explain, to write down this generalization of the Veneziano Yankilovich action to include globals. Mm-hmm. And there is this Farrell and people that they gave. And also Sannino and Merlati, they wrote down an action which generalized this Veneziano Yankilovich action. And with me, we study the spectrum of the. And so it would be interesting also to study.
You want to test those things, but on the other hand, there's the technical issue of can you control these things on the lattice in the continuum limit? So that's why I'm emphasizing that it's interesting not to immediately go to the large volume and see if you see supersymmetry in the finite volume spectrum coming back. But anyway, this is beside the point. To what you want to study, but I just want to say finite size, finite volume effects are not always a problem.
Otherwise, in the analysis of the continuum theory, instant effects also play a very important role. And in your numerical analysis, can you identify specifically the effects of the instant on the you generate instant configuration and maybe you can make analysis?
I don't think so.
Without using any instant on, you are getting the same result.
In that sense, the final volume is actually interesting because if the volume gets too small, it pushes out the instant
contribution.
So in that sense, you can probe this.
Okay, so the idea to study the pattern of this spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking is to roughly see where the value of Kc it is. So it's more or less this one at that time when this was done. It is important to find out this one because then if you want to study the spectrum of your model or whatever thing, world entities, you have to take your configuration in that point, which is the interesting point. So now in the Kurchin-Veneziano formulation, I will spend a couple of minutes in this and then I will try to the other thing. So in the Kurchin-Veneziano formulation, the supersymmetric limit is also achieved by the study of the world identities. And so one can get a value of this one in a very independently way and check whether this is, this is agree or not. And this has been done, and I will show you what happened. Of course, if you are working with the Wilson fermions, when you write down your world identities on the lattice, they will have terms that breaks supersymmetry. So you have to check that your world identity holds not only numerically, but also in the continuum limit. So let me write down the renormalized world identities, which has been written to do numerical simulation. And so these ones are. So, this is the supercurrent. Let me briefly write it down. Well, this is the Clover plaquette. The lattice one definition of the lattice of F mu. Then this one is another current. And this, this is the zeta corresponding to this current, and this is the zeta corresponding to this current here. And then the chi, which is. So the idea is that you write down this, you choose an operator insertion here, okay? And it's not trivial how to choose to get some signal. Then you calculate these correlation functions, and you determine from here the values of your zeta s this M renormalization mass of the gluino, this ratio here, in order to hold the equation, which is a matrix equation. So the results I will show you here, if I can. So I will show you a table with these results for different values of K, your Hopping parameter, and I will show you this value from here. And from here, you can calculate a new value of your critical Hopping parameter and to see if they agree with this one. So this is the value of the zeta t. So forget these two points here, which has very big errors. And here in the vertical is zeta t, zeta s to the minus 1. So in this piece here. and in the horizontal is the 1 over k. So you see from here that there are 3 points simulated for 2 different definition of the supercar. I mean, I can choose on the lattice whatever, and one should choose the one that gets you best signal. So for example, for the local definition of the supercurrent, which is this one here, one can make a fit on these curves and find out that, I mean, this value here was zeta t divided zeta s. I also did a calculation in lattice perturbation theory of this quantity, zeta t, where zeta s is equal to 1 in at order g squared, and I got 0.332, which is, I mean, it's not, it is not so bad, because in lattice perturbation theory, I mean, this is a non-perturbative, and this is perturbative, and it's the same order. And for the other hand, so I will show you.
The line is on what the t mu, the mean of t mu.
Sorry?
T mu at the other is identity.
Sorry?
What the t mu?
T mu is this one, is this operator here.
Why is appearing the word identity? Why t mu appear? I mean, in the continuous data relation, I know.
I mean,
I don't understand the t mu in the equal to me.
I think so. It's a result from the continuum. Your supercurrent makes mixing with this operator here.
In, on the lattice.
On the continuum also.
Also.
I mean, when you study.
In another regularization, because it has the same quantum number, so it is just another. Yeah. Another current which has the same quantum number as SU, if you define the network current.
I mean, when you study the renormalization, sorry.
Yeah.
When you study the renormalization procedure, you have to study all the mixing of your operator with operator of the equal or lower dimension. So this is an operator that has the same.
In that case, naively, you can consider S plus P as a new supersymmetric generator. Then it works. That's what it happens.
Excuse me?
In that case, then you can define mu S mu as S mu times T mu. Then that's the generator of supersymmetry.
Yeah, so the renormalized S is a sum of Z S times S plus Z T times
S. Exactly. I mean, the renormalized. I mean, naively, yeah.
Oh, that's what happened.
And so now let me show you what happened with this ratio here. So again, let us concentrate in that picture here, which is a local definition of the supercurrent, sorry. And here there are 3 points and then a line. So there was done it the simulation in 3 different points. I think so there are update values, but I mean. And then there is this extrapolation to m mass of the green or equal to 0, which would gives you the value of KC. And this KC, which is finding out with these word identities, is in the local definition of the supercurrent, is 0.19647, which, I mean, is great, I would say.
Excuse me. The Galeno is not supposed to be massless, you're going to this on this line, it's supposed to be.
Yeah, you go to this value equal to 0 in order to calculate.
But I thought the idea was this is a first order transition, so nothing is going to 0 max.
So this is a mass minus m.
But the fermion binds with the gluon, so you got a bound state of a fermion gluon, which is some finite mass, isn't it?
No, this is the mass of the gluon itself.
But why should the gluon be massless?
Because otherwise you are breaking supersymmetric software.
No, because the gluon balls are massive too.
So no, but I'm just so to say in the one identities.
Yes. Oh, and the word today is sort of a perturbative thing.
Yeah.
You only have so this is a case. You're saying this is sort of the first terms of something very expansive.
This is the relative mass, if you like. So okay. it is only not broken, the normalized. What identity that if this mass is
okay, so this is the coefficient of this term. This is not the mass of a physical particle. This
yeah.
is
it's not a physical mass,
yeah.
it's just a mass of the domino.
Okay, if I can have 10 minutes more, I will try to skip to another thing I'm doing. So.
This is, of course, might have a little connection to our discussion about
what happened
to the
one. So there are update values of this ratio. I mean, I pick up this one. So this is a work I did with Marisa Bonini, and it's also a work in progress. So it's the four-dimensional Vezzumino model that uses the Ginsberg-Wilson operator.
It's really nice people though. That's a scalar and a fairly
yes.
No gauges right.
Yes, there are no gauges here. So this action here was investigated by Fujikawa, and so we took this action from their paper, and I will write it down here right now. So the action written in real components, okay? So you have the Majorana fields in the Vezzumino action, then you have the scalar field and the auxiliary field. But you can go to the real component. So the real components, you write down, and then so the action is on the lattice. It's going to be a little bit long. And this is the free part of the, I mean, your Vezzumino is the free part plus the interactive part, I mean, the kinetic part plus something that depends on the G and on M.
There are no gauges, so
no.
Being a superdriven or a...
Excuse me?
There are no gauge fields, so is capital D in your notation a super space derivative? What is capital
D? I will, D, do you want to know what is D?
Yes.
I will write it down in a second, I mean, first. Okay, so you have that the Ginsberg-Wilson relation says that gamma phi plus and so one can write down the, I mean, we did write down this, I mean, this is the action that was written by Fujikawa, where we choose this notation here. And the one is the part proportional to the identity. Okay, so 1, 4, trace of D, and D2 is equal to 1, 4. And so you have some fancy relation as, I mean, your Gisbert-Wilson relation can be written as, oh, sorry. Where I use the Neuberger solution, which is, by the way, is not here. So, I mean, and the W is. So this is a solution of, and these are the forward and backward derivative, which does not have gauge fields. Okay, so it is more easy. So and finally, the Majorana condition. So Fujikawa shows that there are some supersymmetric transformation which leaves the free part of the action invariant, while the interactive part does not. So I will write it down here, which were them. So this is our starting point. I mean, this relation here, this supersymmetry transformation, leaves the free part of the action invariant. That means that if you apply the supersymmetry transformation over F0, this is equal to 0. But they do not hold, I mean, if you apply it on the interactive part, these are different from 0. So what we wanted to do is to find out, to realize supersymmetry on the lattice. So one way to do this is to change the action, try to put more pieces here in order to let hold this equation equal to 0. Another way to do this is to keep the action as it is, because, behaves well, and change the transformation. So this idea was also used in a paper by Goltermann, using two-dimensional Bessonian model with Wilson fermion. But so what we did is that we put this operator here, where R is an operator that depends. I mean, we choose that depend on the scalar fields and on the derivative, but not on the fermion fields. And to calculate R, you have to, you calculate R order by order in perturbation theory so that this equation holds. So if you write down R as R1 plus G, R2, etc., you are able to calculate each of these pieces in the perturbation theory. And R, you see, start from G, because this equation here holds in the free limit. So now let me, before show you which is R, R2, etc., I would like to tell you that this expression here, when you study the Brillouin zone and you go to P mu, for example, this one here seems to be a zero mode on the Brillouin zone because, well, I mean, D1 is proportional to sin square of P mu something, okay? I can write it down explicitly. And D2 is sin of P mu A. So if you do this calculation here and you plug it in directly, this value here, you will get that this expression here is infinite by, times zero. So it seems that there is a problem. But I think so, there is no problem in the sense that if you study this limit, I mean, if you don't put directly P over pi over A, but you approach to this quantity by an epsilon, you will see that this quantity here behave as a constant, which I can write it down actually. I mean, it's gamma 4 because I have only this thing divided epsilon times A. And this quantity here, which is equal to this product here, is for A fixed because I am on the lattice. Becomes massive when epsilon goes to zero. So it seems to be not a zero mode, but a very heavy mode. So I think so, there's no problem. So, okay. So let me now... I still have some time?
I think if we end around five, I'm fine, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, okay, thank you. So if you impose this here, you will find out that R1 is something like... Where this is practically the fermion propagator. And delta L is equal to this quantity here, which is 2 plus, okay, other things which behave as the same. So notice that this delta L is different from zero because the Leibniz rule is broken on the lattice. If the Leibniz rule would hold in the lattice, this piece here would cancel exactly with this one and this one with this one, and happen the same here. So, I mean, this R is different from zero because delta L is different from zero on the lattice, but in the continuum would be zero, as should be, I mean. And, well, one can calculate also R2, and the magic thing is that you can, I mean, you have this in perturbation theory, but you suddenly can make a resummation of all this and get a closed form for R, which I will write it down here. It's a bit ugly, but...
Is it a resummation or a guess that works?
No, it's a resummation. It's a resummation. Then, I mean, I don't know if one has to simulate this. How does it work? Times R equal to delta L. So always you see that you have that, I mean, the problem is that you are using chiral fermions. So your problem now is that you don't have the Leibniz rule on the lattice. And so in one sense, your R is restoring the fact that on the lattice you break your Leibniz rule. So now.
You have rho there, but delta L doesn't depend on rho. It's just part of the dimension.
Sorry?
Delta L, of course, does.
Delta L is this thing here. I can write it down.
So now I see how it's a resummation because R is equal to the inverse of this thing, you know, it's delta L.
Yeah. I mean, it's something magic, but it happened. So we also study the closure, if this is an exact symmetry on the lattice, your algebra should close, okay? And so, well, it's a bit complicated to do the calculation, and perhaps I will sketch you what happened. So we were. Oops, sorry. So to study the closure of the algebra, you have to apply two times the supersymmetry transformation on a field and then makes the commutator. So if you do that using these relations there, including the R, okay? So you apply one and then, for example, let me show you the field A, okay? Then it was done for all the scalar fields, auxiliary fields, and the fermion field. So it's something like, well, not it's something, it's equal to. So more or less happened also for B, for F, for G. I mean, you want me to write it down otherwise? So as you can see from here, this piece here is equal to the continuum, okay? Because this one is in the continuum, the two is, okay? Plus a piece that is proportional to G and is different from zero because the Leibniz rule does not hold. So I think so it's very nice. So one can write down in a compact way this fact. Let me write phi is A, B, F, G, and chi, okay? Like alpha mu, a P mu of phi. Then alpha mu is this piece here, so minus. Oh, the mistake here should be. And then P mu is equal to D2 mu phi plus order G. Oh, I mean, this is calculated to order G. One can also do it for bigger, I mean, if one have enough paper. And so you see from here that effectively, you see that here the closure of your algebra is proportional to this operator p mu, which is also happen on the continuum, because this one in the continuum is the mu, plus a piece order OG, which that is this one. Okay, so now once you have this one, I will finish in. So, okay, you can say, well, you have this sort of generalized symmetry on the lattice. How do you know that get the continuum limit or the theory in the continuum without making fine-tuning? So, well, this is a good question, and to answer this question, you have to study the word identities. So we start to study the word entities to order G square. 2 points word entity. Well, for 1 point is almost trivial, and there are no cancellation between the scalar fields. So you cannot. I mean that hold, but you cannot say. I mean nothing more deeply. And well, to order G square, you have that the word entity. One simple word entity is this one here. Plus this GRA. Okay, so if you want to study the order G square, you put here G square, G square, G square, and so, and this is equal to zero. So, because R, it was written in like this, so my word identity will be the same, and this I can write down like GR1. Plus G square okay so you write down propagators etc you construct you write down for example to do this one here you have to put here and then put the part of the action proportional to G square, which I will not write you, and then make all the possible contractions. So we did wrote down this, and then you can also write it down in the momentum space. And when you plug it in all these results here, 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 and here, I get that this one is equal to zero. I mean, these word identities holds on the lattice as fixed lattice spacing. You don't even have to go to the continuum. So this seems magic, but it happened. I mean, we are writing the paper, and so I don't know if there exists a theorem that says that if this hold for fixed A, for A equal to zero holds too. I mean. I would say yes, but I mean, I don't have a...
So the order G squared, the order density certainly holds. So the only issue would be, is there some higher order contribution which would less than two?
No, in this word identity, you don't have other terms. You mean if you go to G to the cube? Yes, I mean, yes, this should be...
It's very comforting, it works at G squared. That's nice.
But in any case, we also studied the continuum limit of this. I mean, we said, okay, I mean, we don't believe in that. So we wrote down the continuum limit of each of these operators because if you write down the continuum limit, you have to, I mean, make an expansion in the external moment. I mean, you will have some diagrams, et cetera, et cetera. And when you do the continuum limit, you can study the momentum structure of each of these two-point functions. And so you can understand what is going on there. And you see that if you plug it in, the continuum limit of each of these things separately also hold. I mean, you get zero. So that means, I think so, that you recover the supersymmetry, I mean, the Vesumino, the supersymmetry in the continuum limit without fine-tuning. I would say, so you have this one. I mean, is this piece? I have to say that these two pieces are finite, so they sum over the other terms in order to hold that. I mean, they are important. So is it? Sorry, what do you want?
So finally, I think this is not so easy because finally you have to define that there is an operator, there are operators, renormalized operators, which satisfy the supersymmetry algebra.
For example?
It's a non-trivial thing. You know, I mean, you were writing some transformations, but really having the supersymmetry means that you have operators in your Hilbert space, you know, which means that then you can say that the state, physical states are the general and the amplitudes are supersymmetric, so you have to construct at the end, which is very difficult to do, operators of your supersymmetry transformations.
So it is not enough to say that I recover the supersymmetry in the continuum.
You always have one identity for the chiral symmetry, which is equal to zero. But then you have lots of terms. You remember the chiral one identity derivation. This is an exact identity also at non-zero lattice spacing. This is not the problem. So you always have an exact identity. But then, of course, you have to prove that there is a continuity of this with randomized operators, and that is the difficult part.
But I think so is what I just told you. I mean, I calculate the continuum limit of each of these operators here, and that means that you make an expansion. I mean, you have quantities that are divergence, and so you expand in Taylor, then you subtract your operator for external momenta equal to zero, and you make your Taylor expansion up the order of the divergence. And so I plug it in there, and I saw that holds. So I don't know.
But finally, you want to.
That means that the wave function renormalization of each, I mean, of my field phi, f, and chi should be equal. Otherwise, would not hold.
Yes, but you want to prove or say at some point that, for instance, your physical states.
Ah, okay, yes.
In a super mode.
If you want, okay.
Your S matrix is supersymmetric and so on. And this is.
Yeah, of course, this is a step forward, yeah.
Well, if your supersymmetry is something that you can imagine in a transfer matrix homology in the non space, in other words, it would have to be non local in time.
It looks like it's non local.
Yeah.
Where do you say that this is non local?
R is non local.
Well, I mean,
Well,
I don't know. I mean, to order G square, I don't think so. There is something.
I'm not saying that.
I mean, if you take a look.
That'd
yeah.
be very surprising to order that input out, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I can show you my. I mean, does come out exactly.
Yeah, no.
I mean, I don't think it's a necessary condition, but it would be sufficient for the S matrix to. Be something you could decompose into supersymmetric states. I guess you could talk about supersymmetry for one time slice.
The question he's using is funny to act operative.
If these operators, for example, decay exponentially, that might be good enough.
Yeah, I think. Well, these operators here. I mean, they are made using the overlap firm. I mean. They contain this operator like this, which.
What would happen if you use Wilson?
I don't know, and I mean, we wanted to use Ginsberg, the Ginsberg-Wilson operator. I don't think so. That works with Wilson fermions. I don't think so, but I mean, I haven't done the calculation, so I cannot say this.
Well, it was
going to
be easier.
Well, but maybe the fact that she uses the Ginsberg-Wilson, which has a chiral symmetry.
That might be crucial.
Well, in fact,
the chiral symmetry at finite value spacing.
In fact, that is true. I mean, this equation that I wrote before, which is d1 squared minus d2, which is the Ginsberg-Wilson relation, and the other ones that you can take from here. I mean, they work during all the calculation. I mean, I think so. It's crucial. This. I mean, I cannot. Yeah. Yes. So I think so. Yeah. But I haven't done the calculation with Wilson, and I don't know if I am would be interested. Anyway, this is a procedure that can be applied if you have. An action which has a part which is free, and then something that is multiplied by g. So this should work. We start from this because we want to study super young mix, but this is not going to work because in super young mix you have all mixed up. So, I mean, okay, I finished.